I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Rob Nixon, professor of English and author of Dreambirds, The Strange History of the Ostrich. We're talking about Rachel Carson, and I'm wondering, is there a link there between your interest in Rachel Carson and your work on the ostrich?
Yes, I think there are two very early, very, very strong links for me. Unlike Rachel Carson, I grew up 10 minutes from the ocean, in this case the Indian Ocean in South Africa. And one of the peculiarities of growing up in South Africa, and there were many, was that television was banned until the late 70s. So I'd actually finished college before I saw my first television set. So I grew up in a world completely without screens, without TV screens, computer screens, anything like that. And some of my happiest and earliest memories were of going down to the beach with the family and being parked in front of the tidal pools, my brother and I. The tidal pools became a kind of a childminder. You know, it was like flicking channels because things were changing all the time. Either we were wandering from pool to pool or the tides were changing. And I remember just sitting in front of these for hours and prodding under the rocks and poking with a net and having a bucket there and getting a full sense of the creatureliness of the world through the smell and the touch, the spikiness of things. And there was this also a sense, I think, in which those pools introduced me to storytelling, because with the ebb and flow of the tides, there's a sense in which there's a movement from concealment to revelation, an element of suspense, epiphanies, something is hidden as something is revealed. And so later, when I was about 9 or 10, I'd start following the tidal charts in the newspaper, so I had a better sense of what I might find. But there were always these serendipities. And to me, Carson is the most eloquent writer of the tidal pool, which was so formative in my early years. The second bit, and which leads to the book on the memoir on the ostrich, was that in my teen years, I was determined to become an ornithologist. I was absolutely obsessed with birds and wanted to be a biologist with a focus in ornithology. And so for me, even now, wherever I travel, my first awareness of it is of birds, just as somebody else's could be of architecture or food or language. Without bird watching, I will just enter a place and get a gut sense of whether the bird life is interesting or relatively parched. And so for me, just the idea of the Keats poem, The No Birds Sing, and Silent Spring, and the chapter particularly on the devastation of bird life and the devastation on my imaginative sense of what it means to be alive touches something that's very much at the core of me.
Silent Spring was, as you said, Rob, controversial when it came out. Controversial at the University of Wisconsin for one place.
Mm-hmm.
How did the message finally prevail? Was it just more and more data that kept coming out supporting Rachel Carson's assertions in the book?
I think it's the strength of the writing, the strength of the research, but also the trajectory of the publicity, which took a very interesting form. First of all, it was serialized in the spring of 1962 in The New Yorker, and it was one of those books like John Hersey's Hiroshima, which had an impact before it was published because of the New Yorker's reputation, because The New Yorker at that stage would publish these very long pieces. So it had an initial impact through the magazine. Then the book itself caused a tremendous stir, and her editor at Houghton Mifflin said that the controversy stirred up by the pesticides industry and so forth gave them a degree of publicity they could absolutely never have afforded. So it really helped the sales of the book. A third factor was the CBS documentary on Silent Spring and the pesticides debate, which appeared in 1963. And that was watched by 10 million viewers, which would be the equivalent to something like 20 million today. A couple of the program sponsors withdrew their advertising ahead of time. They received many letters urging them not to, ahead of time, they received many letters urging them not to broadcast the program. I think 1,000 letters mimeographed from pesticide industry officials. A week or two after the appearance of that film, President Kennedy was asked in a news conference about pesticides and what the government was doing about it, and he referenced Rachel Carson. He set up Senate hearings into the impact of pesticides, and their conclusions were very similar to Carson's conclusions. By the end of 1963, I think 40 states had adopted laws controlling the use and labeling of pesticides. So there was a snowball effect, I think, in terms of the publicity machine, some of which was controlled, some of which was inadvertent.
It must have been very frustrating to Rachel Carson, after having the courage to write this book, to be ill and to die just a year after this.
Yes. I mean, it's better than, say, somebody like Melville, who his reputation, is so vast, and yet he got to enjoy so little of it. But she had a really tough time with health. A friend of hers who'd known her for about 19 years said that in all of those 19 years, she'd never known her well. She was struggling with rheumatism, having cortisone injections. She struggled with her eyes. She had heart problems. She had this, I think, in 1960, when she was diagnosed with cancer, she had the radical mastectomy and then started chemotherapy. She kept the condition of her health very private, and clearly she was concerned that particularly the section of the book dealing with cancers would be taken as biased because it was personally inflected. So when she appeared in the 1963 documentary, she appeared in a rather startling black wig, and she clearly looked enervated. So she limited the traveling that she did with the book. I mean, she would have got some satisfaction, clearly, from the impact it was already having. It would have been a lot more satisfying had she got to the 1970s and actually seen some of these federal laws begin to have their impact.
Because the environmental movement really did take off somewhere around 1969.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you have Earth Day in 1970 and these landmark laws in 72, 73, I think.
And how do you see the sort of the legacy of Rachel Carson today? You know, as you're talking about some of these things, it seems to me we're still struggling with many battles that are equivalent to the DDT.
Absolutely. For one thing, there's an environmental rollback. That's not news, but in terms of issues, basic issues like air quality, water quality, there's also an issue that's concerned me greatly recently, which is the toxic residues of war. And I think this is something that needs more attention and really fits right into what Rachel Carson said, blindness to what she called death by indirection, a bleak death. And since the 1991 Gulf War, depleted uranium, which has something like 60% of the radioactivity of natural uranium and has a half-life of 4.5 billion years, has been used in tank armor and in missiles and in military ordnance. The Gulf War was the first of these depleted uranium wars. And depleted uranium carries both a chemical and a radiological threat and has been labeled by the United Nations Commission of Human Rights as a weapon of mass destruction. Its carcinogenic effects sometimes take 10 to 15 years to kick in. It makes a post-war environment particularly toxic to children who are more susceptible to radiation and who tend to play in abandoned tanks and so forth in these environments. So I think one of the ways in which this concerns me is in a way that Rachel Carson really spoke to, which is the imprecision, the environmental and therefore epidemiological imprecision of so much that we label technologically precise. You know, we talk about smart warfare or precision-guided weapons or a surgical attack. And what does it mean to call somebody a survivor of a war if they then die a death of painful prematurity 5 years, 10 years later? We've seen this with Agent Orange. Clearly, children who were not even born during the Vietnam War are still dying early as a result of the kind of ricochet effect through the food chain of the toxins that remained after that war. And so I think these concerns around the technological hubris and the language of euphemism around precision, I think, are really at the heart of her work and carry over beyond the question of pesticides into so many realms of contemporary life.
Rob Nixon has been our guest as we have discussed the life and the very significant and effective writings of Rachel Carson. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much for inviting me.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for that next hour of University of the Air.
B Because you value the discussion you hear on Wisconsin Public Radio, we're inviting you to visit our website to become a member at any time. Go to WPR.org and click on membership information. The Ideas Network is as good as it is because of listeners like you.